Psalm 55. Listen to my prayer, O God. Do not ignore my plea. Hear me and answer me. My thoughts trouble me, and I am distraught at the voice of the enemy, at the stares of the wicked. For they bring down suffering upon me and revile me in their anger. My heart is in anguish within me. The terrors of death assail me. Fear and trembling have beset me. Horror has overwhelmed me. I said, "Oh, that I had the wings of a dove! I would fly away and be at rest. I would flee far away and stay in the desert. I would hurry to my place of shelter, far from the tempest and storm. But I call to God, and the Lord saves me. Evening, morning, and noon I cry out in distress, and He hears my voice. He ransoms me unharmed from the battle waged against me, even though many oppose me. God, who is enthroned forever, will hear them and afflict them, men who never change their ways and have no fear of God. My companion attacks his friends. He violates his covenant. His speech is smooth as butter, yet war is in his heart. His words are more soothing than oil, yet they are drawn swords. Cast your cares on the Lord, and He will sustain you. He will never let the righteous fall. But you, O God, will bring down the wicked into the pit of corruption. Bloodthirsty and deceitful men will not live out half their days. But as for me, I trust in you."
So what happens to your body when you're afraid? Of course, it depends on the level of fear, but it doesn't really depend on the actual threat. Perceived threat is the real factor in fear. So for instance, a child may try to pet a crocodile but run screaming from a mouse costume at Chuck E. Cheese. So it's not the real threat, it's the perceived threat that triggers fear. Anything perceived as a threat trips the amygdala, the brain's hand-ringing sentry who stands there watching guard. And if you scare this sentry, then he starts ringing the alarm, and this sets in motion the biochemical cascade known as the fight-or-flight response. And some people are now referring to this as the survival stress response. Bruce Siddle's an expert on these matters, and he gives my favorite summary of what happens next. He said, "You become fast, strong, and dumb." And so when you are afraid, it's not a great time to be making big decisions because we just don't tend to think rationally then. A burst of adrenaline prompts a cortisol dump in the bloodstream. The lungs go into overdrive to get more oxygen. The heart rate doubles or triples to deliver the oxygen more swiftly. The liver starts spewing glucose, more fuel for the task. And then to get these goods to where the body needs it, the blood vessels in the large muscles of the arms and legs, they dilate. The lower priority organs get less blood, like gut and skin, so you feel things in your skin, lose your appetite, bye-bye fine motor skills. The prefrontal cortex, which is a blood guzzler, gets rationed, goodbye reasoning and analysis. And so then to make matters worse, the adrenaline that primes the muscles also enhances nerve activity, so it makes you tremble and shake. And all these are why when people are stressed or afraid, their thinking goes down to very simple processes. And so the average police officer on a firing range will score 85 to 90%, but in actual firefights in the street, the average is about 18%. And today we're going to look at fear in the Psalms and in our lives, and fear causes this chemical response to perceived threats. We've established that. But that's not really fear. That's the body's auto response. Fear comes from what we think and feel and believe about threats and our lack of safety. Fear is much more complex than the physical responses we have to it. Fear can be really bad. Fear can be really good. A person who has persistent fear responses and the chemical reaction that comes from that, it can degrade their bodies and minds over time. That's why a PTSD is so damaging to a person's body, because we're not made to have that cortisol dump all the time. Living in disorienting fear can also degrade us spiritually, and it can degrade relationships, it can degrade us emotionally. So fear can harm us, but not all fear is bad. In fact, in the physical world, it's important that children, for instance, learn to not pet crocodiles. It's a fear has a good response. In the spiritual world, a properly oriented fear is also essential. So some level of fear of falling into sin is a good thing, because sin is a threat to us. And this kind of fear can lead to wise action, like running from certain situations. So when it comes to temptation, the fight or flight response is good, and the fight response is bad. The flight response is good. Just get out of there. And people who don't have a fear of sin can devastate their lives. Fear is normal. The person who doesn't ever experience fear is not brave or full of faith. They might be naive. They might have a mental disorder. They might just be apathetic. In fact, the person who is fearful yet still shows up is a brave person. And the person who feels no fear isn't brave. They're just not having that response. But the person who, for instance, is afraid of or anxious in public settings and shows up, that's a courageous person. So what makes you afraid? What made you afraid last week? What makes you afraid right now? Sometimes our fear can be specific. It could be focused on someone or something that's a known threat. Sometimes our fear can be vague, nonspecific. We call that anxiety. Some call it the little fear. But when you have anxiety, and I have had it, it doesn't seem like the little fear at all. Conventional wisdom says there's a correlation between increased age and increased fear. You get older, you become afraid of more things. Well, correlation does not imply causation. So sometimes you get older, you're afraid of more things because you have more experiences. Sometimes it's just because you have swapped fears, fear for fear. As I get older, I fear some things much less and other things much more. But it's not directly related to just calendar days. You know, back in World War II, they thought a fighter pilot couldn't be a good fighter pilot after 25. And the implication was, we need these guys to do very dangerous things, and they're dumb enough to do that before 25. And they realized that wasn't necessarily the case. No offense if you're under 25, but that really wasn't the case, because you want people with more experience. Worry and fear are cousins. They have in common the reaction to things that we can't control. Fear is provoked when the threat of danger, physical or relational, exposes our inability to preserve what we cherish most. Maybe it's a fear of losing loved ones, our possessions, our health. We fear the loss of these things that we cherish, and we can't ultimately control whether we keep them. Maybe we fear the loss of self-esteem, our perceived position among people. We fear being judged. We fear being alone. We fear being needy. Satan uses fear as a tool. In Hebrews 2:14 and 15, it says, since the children have flesh and blood, he too shared in their humanity, so that by his death he might destroy him who holds the power of death, that is the devil, and free those who all their lives were held in slavery by their fear of death. And of course, Satan doesn't hold our life in his hands. So the power of death here is the fear of death. We all die. It's fear that becomes the prison. Because if you remember in Psalms 90, verse 20, it says that if we reflect on the shortness of our days, i.e. our death, then we gain a heart of wisdom. So paying attention to the reality of death can lead to wisdom. So clearly it's not the reality of death that enslaves, but the fear of it. And so Satan can cause us to see death from his perspective, use it to invoke fear, while the psalmist in Psalm 90 and other places encourage us to reflect on death in light of the goodness and power of God, so that we would have wise lifestyles. It doesn't mean that people who fear death are less spiritual. There are people who don't believe in God who don't have a fear of death. And there are people who do love God and do believe the gospel who, for a variety of reasons, have fear of death. The point is, fear, not death itself, is the enemy's tool of enslavement. For some people, the thought of losing face is more fearful than losing their lives. Fear and anger are both responses to threats to our ability to control outcomes. And so anger is the fight response, fear is the flight response. Anger attacks, fear withdraws. Let's look at Psalm 55, four things we learn from David's response to fear as Greg read that to us. First, David's heart was full of fear. He admitted it. Verses 4 and 5, my heart is in anguish within me. The terrors of death assail me. Fear and trembling have beset me. Horror has overwhelmed me. He's suffering pretty severe anxiety here. His heart is in anguish. His fear is showing up mentally and physically. He's trembling. He feels horror. And for me, it's challenging that David admitted to this level of fear, publicly admitted it. I mean, he's a combat veteran, he's a king, and he's willing to admit his fear. This man after God's own heart is not afraid of looking unspiritual by his fear, and neither should we. Honesty strikes me as a good and important starting point in thinking about fear. Second, he wants to run. Fear is the flight response, and David literally wants to fly. Oh, that I had the wings of a dove, I would fly away and be at rest. I would flee far away and stay in the desert. I would hurry to my place of shelter, far from the tempest and storm. Doves were around then, very popular, well-known bird. They would hunt them and they would see them. And they would fly away out of the city, away from the chaos of the city, and they would nest in these crevices and cliffs outside the city. And so I can imagine David is reflecting on times when he was a shepherd outdoors, tending his sheep. Maybe a storm has beset him. He's nowhere to go. He's out there drenched in rain, miserable. And he looks up and he sees these doves nestled up in these cracks, warm and safe. And so in his fear, he's laying there in his room at night in his fear, and he's thinking about this picture and just thinking, boy, it'd be nice to be able to just fly away. He wants out of the stressful, anxiety-inducing situation. You know, this seems to be a normal, sane approach. A flight from fear is not irrational. It's just not always helpful. Certainly the desire, the emotion to flee is normal. That's normal. But what are we to do with that emotion? And I would say, by all means, get out of threatening conditions if you can. But often fear is about the future, something that's coming. And how do you flee from the future? You really don't, except by worrying about it today. And so look at what David did. He continually cries out to God. Verse 17, evening, morning, and noon, I cry out in distress, and he hears my voice. So through all three shifts, 3 8-hour shifts, he's training to trust God 24/7. So his fear is around the clock. His turning to God is around the clock. He's not merely trying to not be afraid. He's training to trust God with his future. And sometimes, for a period of time, only God knows how long, this is our solution for fear. And you can say, well, Terry, that's not actually a solution. Turning to God is not a solution. A solution would be turning to God so God would answer and then take away my feelings of fear or take away the cause for my fear itself. But crying out to God is a request for a solution, not a solution in itself. I don't agree. Very often, crying out to God is the solution for now. And we can ask God to remove the fear and or the cause of fear, but he may choose to give you what you need minute by minute by minute. That, by the way, is not my favorite solution, but it's been my solution at times in my life. And for us, the continually crying out to God is a key part of the solution, because it is when we are turning towards him, that we're experiencing what matters most. And by all means, ask God to remove the threat. If my grandkids are sick, I'm going to ask God to remove the threat. But if our hearts are not being oriented back to him, he could remove all the known threats, and he's not taking care of anything, because we can turn anything into a threat. We can turn any person, we can turn any event into a perceived threat. And we know that. We've had threats removed and the fear remains. Tomorrow becomes a threat. And drives our fear. So Jesus said in Matthew 6:34, don't worry about tomorrow. Tomorrow, worry about itself. Every day has enough trouble of its own. And so how do we deal with that? Well, the verse before, verse 33, says, but seek first his kingdom and his righteousness, and all these things will be given to you. So what are all the things that will be given to you? I've heard that claimed as a promise of God to kind of give you whatever you want. That is not the context here. The context here is that people are spending today worrying about, will I have what I need tomorrow? And he specifically mentioned food and clothes and drink. And Jesus said we're to spend today seeking to be faithful, seek the kingdom first, rather than trying not to fear tomorrow. And so our reorientation to God is not when God fixes all of our problems, but it happens as we keep turning our attention and affection back to him. And our goal, my goal, is God, please fix this. And it's okay to ask God to fix this. Take away the fear and or the threat, the cause of fear, the feelings of fear. But most often when the threat is removed, we have a burst of initial gratitude followed by growing spiritual apathy. Sadly, that's true most of the time. When there's no perceived threat, we have no perceived need for God because life is back under, we think, our control. And so crying out to God is an ongoing solution to our largest threat. The largest threat a human faces is a perceived lack of need for God, a life lived independent of Him. That's the largest threat to a human being. And then four, his confidence is in the objective reality of God, not the subjective feelings about a situation. So in verse 19, again, you see this statement of faith. God, who is enthroned forever, He's eternal, and He's the King. He's enthroned forever. He will hear them and afflict them. He's going to act. Justice will come. And so his fear in this case was derived from enemies who want to destroy him, and his confidence is in the eternal God. So whatever the cause of your fear, the reason for your confidence is the same. It's God. And the goal must be to grow in confidence in God, not merely to eliminate the cause or the feelings of fear. So here's what David models in this passage. First, he models honesty with fear. He's not afraid of looking unspiritual by his fear. And often we believe, I'm not sure why, but we believe that if we are spiritual, if we're really advanced in our faith, we're not ever going to fear. I don't know where that idea comes from. It doesn't come from the Bible. It's really not a Christian worldview. Second, we see that a normal desire to run from his fears is present in David's life. But he doesn't do that. He doesn't run from faithfulness to God. Third, we see this continually turn to God is a solution in and of itself. And then fourth, his confidence, his statement of faith is rooted in the objective realities of God, not the subjective experience of his emotions, because our emotions are running all over the place. So a wicked problem is a term used, first coined back in the 60s, 70s, but it was in the world of business management. Now it's used in the military and other places, but it's not an evil problem, but it's a complex problem that's resistant to simple solutions. And so there are a lot of characteristics of wicked problems, but one is every wicked problem is essentially unique. So you can't just come up with a solution and say, okay, I'm good to go, because every single one is going to have variations. Second, there's no immediate test of a solution. How do you know when it's solved? It's hard to figure out when it's solved, if it's solved. And then every wicked problem can be assumed to be symptoms of other deeper or variant problem. So let's look at fear as a wicked problem. What we most want when we experience fear is relief. And we want relief yesterday. And so we go after ways to get relief from our fear, which is normal and understandable. If you're afraid at high school or junior high or college, there's certain things that you're afraid of people or afraid of peers or afraid of flunking tests or you name it, there's fears. Then the things that we pursue to get relief from fear can have unintended consequences that can be more harmful than fear itself. So, for instance, I've known people who were no longer afraid of death. They were afraid of death, and they were no longer afraid of death because they no longer cared about life. And I've known people who people they work with said, we don't understand. We thought they were better because they were so depressed, so anxious, so fearful, and then they became happy. And then they took their lives. And what happened was they got relief because there was now a solution. They no longer feared life and death because they'd resolved, I'm going to die. So they no longer cared about life at all. I'm no longer anxious around people because I'm not going to go around people anymore. I heard a story on the radio yesterday, NPR, about a guy who the way he deals with his anxiety is he lives by himself. Or I'm no longer anxious about people because I've learned to not care about people. Or I take certain drugs before I go around people. Some of our problems resist easy, quick solutions, and these are wicked problems. And I hope that we learn to see our problems not merely as things to be solved so we can move on in life. And I'm all about solving problems, but for us, often moving on in life means getting back to life where we don't need God anymore, or we don't perceive we do. And so if we can learn to see our problems, like fear, as ways that God intends to get inroads deeper into our lives, not that we shouldn't try to become less fearful, but the solutions need to be real solutions. And we desire to move through life unencumbered by anything that gets in the way of our satisfaction. And so what that means is very often God becomes a means to our own greater ends. And so God, instead of being the end of our desire, becomes a means to our desire. And what is this desire? Very often it's a life more fully under our command and control. That's often our ultimate desire. We want God to use his power to fix things. But in my heart at least, we want him to fix things so that we won't need him anymore. At least not as deeply as we need him when we're really struggling. So here's a summary of my own testimony. If I think deeply about my own fear and anger, I'm afraid. I desperately feel my need for you. I'm anxious. I desperately feel my anxiety. And there was a period of time in my life where for months I prayed every minute, God, take this anxiety, take this anxiety. And what I really wanted was I wanted to get back to being able to handle life on my own again. I was deeply uncomfortable with my lack of control. I was deeply uncomfortable. I didn't verbalize this, didn't really realize at the time, but years of retrospection on that, I was deeply uncomfortable with how much I was feeling my need for God. And so we're okay with a God who has power to help us. We're just not okay with really needing him, with having him having command and control over our lives. So in the Bible, there are really two fears, God and everything else. Psalm 147, 11, the Lord delights in those who fear him, who put their hope in his unfailing love. And Psalm 111, 10, the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom, and all who follow his precepts have good understanding. To him belongs eternal praise. So fear of the Lord is a good thing. But in the New Testament, look in 1 John 4:18, there is no fear in love, but perfect love drives out fear because fear has to do with punishment. And the one who fears is not made perfect in love. Those are not in opposition to one another. They're two different approaches to the same thing. In 1 John specifically, it's about we don't fear God in the same way as we would have without Christ, without a mediator. And so we do fear God, but it's not a fear that causes us to flee from him or fight him. Let's look at Hebrews 12. It's a fairly complex passage, so we're just gonna do a cursory look at it, but look at some points that are pertinent to this morning. Let me read starting in verse 18. And I want you to get the emotion of this. Try to get the emotion of this. Don't get tripped up in the terminology, but just get the feel for it. You've not come to a mountain that can be touched, that is burning with fire, to darkness, gloom, and storm, to a trumpet blast, or to such a voice speaking words that those who heard it begged that no further word be spoken to them, because they could not bear what was commanded. If even an animal touches the mountain, it must be stoned. The sight was so terrifying that Moses said, I'm trembling with fear. You get the emotion here. Now, this is a fearful, fearful experience. He's talking about the Sinai event where God visited his people and delivered the law. And the mood here is one of terror. A mountain so holy because of God's presence that to touch it is to die. Even Moses, the one invited up, was terrified. He was trembling with fear. And this is a picture of God's presence unmediated by a Savior. His power, his glory, his goodness, his holiness, they're all so unspeakable and unthinkably beyond us that if we could get a glimpse, the response would be pure terror. But then let's go on. Look at where he goes next. Verse 22, but you have come to Mount Zion, to the heavenly Jerusalem, the city of the living God. And so Mount Zion, heavenly Jerusalem, is just an analogy, a picture of being with God, the people of God in God's city living in his presence. You come to thousands upon thousands of angels in joyful assembly, to the church of the firstborn believers whose names are written in heaven. You've come to God, the judge of all men, to the spirits of righteous men made perfect. People have died and now they're in God's presence and their salvation is complete. They've been made perfect. To Jesus, the mediator of a new covenant, and the sprinkled blood that speaks a better word than the blood of Abel. And so he says, he gives this terrifying scene, and there's this strong adversative word, a word that introduces an opposite. But you've come not to Sinai, not to the law-giving, fear-inducing, don't touch. You've come to Zion, the home of God's people. And you've come to God through a mediator, through Jesus. Not the law of Sinai, but the covenant of grace. And what is this about Jesus' blood speaking a better word than Abel's blood? That's kind of strange on the surface. But Abel was murdered by his brother. fresh out of the Garden of Eden, fresh out of living in direct experience of God, separated from God now, a man murders his own brother. And so Abel's blood is speaking a word. And what is that word? Judgment. Sin deserves judgment. Sin demands judgment. So what is a better word that Jesus' blood speaks? Grace. We don't experience judgment. The better word is good news. And so we don't come with a fear that creates separation, a fear that's full of terror, a fear of law and potential death. The perfect love of Christ has driven away that fear. And so now our fear is reverence, it's awe, it's respect, it's love. But his holiness and his power are now something for the believer, if we understand the gospel. They're what draws us to him. The very thing that invoke terror are the things that draw us. And then as we're drawn into God, our hearts move out in love for other people. That's always the process you see in Scripture, over and over and over. Love for God, he draws us in, then turns our heart out in love for other people. We move out into the world being faithful to express the love he's given to us. We move out of our comfort zones because we're learning to love God. You say, I get all that, and I believe the gospel, but I still feel afraid. And I think that the point of the psalm is for us to examine, what is the feeling of fear telling you? What are you going to do with it? What are you going to allow it to do for you? And then what's the solution? Is the solution run from it, hide from it, mask it? Some people spend their lives fearing when fear will return. And the solution, I think, in the Scriptures is movement back towards God and others. Running from fear is trying not to fear. It's win-lose, 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 pass-fail, pass-fail. A lot of failing, a lot of losing. Movement towards God in the Bible is training. It's relationship. It's not pass-fail. And when we turn the Christian life into the law, pass-fail, win-lose, we're going to spend our lives in kind of perpetual bondage. But in the New Testament, the battle's been won for you, and now train to experience the victory that's always been won. So training is relationship. So will the fear go away if I do all this? If I do this, whatever this is, will the fear go away? You know, fear as a feeling may or may not continue to rise up inside of us. But fear is an animating force in our lives that directs the course of our life. We'll start losing its grip. But if the question is, okay, now if I really do some things, can I no longer have these fears and anxiety? Then remember, you're not moving out in love for God and others in order to not fear. God himself is the end, not the means to the end. So I would say, yes, as we move towards God, fear is no longer going to be the animating force in our lives. But fear is a feeling. It's going to come and go based on a lot of factors. And I would say don't measure growth too soon. It's really difficult to tell whether growth is happening in any area of our lives day to day when it's a lifelong process. Because growth is like this, or it's like this, two step forward, one step back. And so it's important to not measure what's happening in your life based on your current mood or feeling. Right now, this side of heaven, life is a trajectory. It's direction now, perfection then. And fear is driven by real and imagined future threats. And so we can't just live our lives trying not to be afraid, trying to be more courageous, but we can live our lives training to trust God. And training to trust God is being faithful to what God's put in front of you right now. So if you wanted to, if you're looking for maybe a hook, okay, what do I do with all this nebulous stuff, is if you spend your life trying to be more courageous, trying not to fear tomorrow, that's fine, but it's probably, that's playing defense all the time. Playing offense is, like Jesus said in Matthew 6, seek first kingdom of God today. What does it look like to be faithful today? And the movement in the Scripture is faithfulness today is going to be moved towards God, and as you move towards God, he's going to have you move towards other people. So most often, the what of being faithful today is going to be the who who has God put in front of you to love. And what's so beautiful about this process is fear traps us inside of ourselves, and this movement pushes us out towards other people. Let's pray together.